Africans need to seize opportunities, but sometimes we always sit and wait for others to come and tell us what to do.
I can show you the world.
Hello and welcome to yet another educating episode of the Climate Talk podcast. This is a podcast where we focus on everything climate. From climate change to climate action, climate finance to climate deniers, everything climate actually. And it's always a great pleasure for me to engage with environmentalists, policymakers, professionals, thought leaders from all walks of life. And together we have very interesting conversations with the ultimate aim of making sure you, my listener, have a better understanding about the environment and also take the proper actions towards making our world a sustainable place to live in. This podcast, Climate Talk, is brought to you by the International Climate Change Development Initiative and the Media for Community Change Initiative. Thank you indeed for making our time to listen to this episode of the Climate Talk podcast. My name is Seyi Funmi Adebote. Welcome, let's get started. On the previous episode of Climate Talk podcast, I had one of Kenya's leading environmentalists discuss with me a lot about climate change. His name is Dr. Mithika Wanda. He is the executive director of the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance, based in Nairobi, Kenya, but working across Africa, doing a really great job. And we had so much to talk about. If you missed out on the last episode, which was really engaging, please do well to check out for the link and listen to that interesting conversation with Dr. Mithika Wanda, where he mentioned one thing that still strikes and stands out: no government is powerful than the people. Well, this new episode happens to be one of my most interesting conversations. It was such a privilege for me to sit down with a man who has been working for the last 10 years with the United Nations. He's visited every country on the African continent. He's visited virtually every other continent. And is best known for what he does best, advocating and championing the roles of young people in addressing climate change. He needs no further introduction, but then listen to this.
Africans need to seize opportunities, but sometimes we always sit and wait for others to come and tell us what to do. A great idea from a youth can actually solve the problem of a mother in the village. Policy implementation will not be done by government per se. It will be done by people, the individual citizens, and the bulk of them are the youth.
That is the voice of my guest on this episode of the Climate Talk podcast show. He works with the United Nations Environment Programs as the Climate Change Coordinator for African Region. And he also leads ecosystem-based adaptation for food security. His book, Making Africa Work Through the Power of Innovative Volunteerism, has transformed the way young people, thousands of young people, think about volunteering. At this point, I know you are itching to get into the conversation with Dr. Richard Munnang and I. But very quickly, let me remind you that the Climate Talk podcast is a monthly podcast where I engage environmentalists, thought leaders, policymakers, and we discuss about everything climate. And it is brought to you by the International Climate Change Development Initiative and Media for Community Change Initiative. My name is Seyi Funmi Adebote, and in the few minutes ahead, it is Dr. Richard Munnang and I discussing climate change, food security, innovative volunteerism, all perfectly captured in the African context. Welcome once again. This is the Climate Talk podcast.
Work at a very high level, making policies and trying to communicate the whole concept of climate change. But then how do you get people at the grassroots level to relate to this concept of climate change?
Yeah, thank you very much for the question. Climate action is about people. And if you look at the African continent today, the most vulnerable people are the people at the grassroots. And what I have actually learned throughout my 10-year career with the United Nations Environment is that the United Nations Environment inform policy based on the reality of people on the ground, because it is informed based on the work that has already been done on the ground, and our role is to fill gaps in policy. So we're actually working with those people on the ground who actually are already feeling the impacts of climate change, whether it's as a result of drought, like in the Sahel or the Horn of Africa, or flooding that actually is causing a lot of havoc across the entire continent on so many people. So what happens is that there are three ways to look at this. Action is already happening on the ground. Our mothers in villages are coping with climate change anyway. When there are droughts, they will trek long distances to fetch water. They're doing that. They're trekking long distances to grow their food, and they're actually not even having an opportunity to afford chemicalized fertilizer. They're using organic manure and organic approaches. They're using conservation agriculture, less soil tillage. They're planting trees, they're planting tefruce, which is nutritious, and they're planting leguminous. So in a way, they're contributing to the environment and building climate resilience, but they're not recognized. So our role is that policy should be able to integrate those aspects that are already happening so that they can be linked to policy, even though they don't know that they're linked to policy. And that has actually been the way that we have been trying to engage people. But more importantly, if you look at the continent today, the mothers in villages that are suffering already the brunt of climate change, there are also youth. We have almost about 720 million of them in the continent. So if you are talking of a continent of about 1.2 billion citizens and you have 720 million youth, it means that that should even be the target. Because a great idea from a youth can actually solve the problem of a mother in the village. Because policy implementation will not be done by government per se. It will be done by people, the individual citizens, and the bulk of them are the youth. So our engagement of the youth now, especially through this logic of innovative volunteerism, through the framework of EPAPOSA, it's now hard to translate also those policy aspects, engaging the right people to help the mothers that are actually living in villages and already doing what the world needs, but not bringing it to scale, so that their efforts can actually be supported.
Exactly. You've touched so much on climate adaptation now in this context. How about the mitigation, and how practical results are we getting to see out there?
Actually, Africa is a negligible emitter. So in essence, mitigation in Africa should be to advance adaptation. It's a continent that have it's emitting about roughly 1.3 to 1.5. Yeah. And the countries that are actually contributing to this are very few. It's South Africa, and then you take Northern African countries. So, but Sub-Saharan Africa is actually a zero net emitter. If you look at the Congo forest, so the little emissions that happen in the continent, we have carbon sinks, which then absorb them. We have the carbon sinks, and not only absorbing for Africa, but also because Africa emissions are negligible, but also for other continents. But what Africa has been suffering, because the continent GDP, gross domestic product, is driven through the agrarian sector, the agricultural sector, which is the most impacted sector by climate change. Because the agricultural sector is mostly rain-fed. What does that mean? It means that if Africa is to survive under the changing climate, it must be able to adapt. So adaptation is a priority for the African continent. And to be able to adapt, Africa can look at ways in which they are not going to increase their emissions, but actually utilize approaches that are supposed to mitigate instead to be able to advance the adaptation ways. For example, if you are using solar power irrigation, which reduces emissions, the intention is not necessarily to reduce emissions, because solar power irrigation is effective and efficient as compared to diesel power, which is more expensive and actually
not sustainable.
So though you will not be increasing emissions, you will also be helping yourself to reduce the efficiency, because it has higher efficiency in terms of water conservation. So we are seeing that from an adaptation perspective, because you can irrigate your crops and they can be able to grow despite the fact that you don't have water because of drought. You can be able to add value to what you produce utilizing solar energy. For example, solar dryers, drying your vegetables, drying your tomatoes, processing your cassava. You're adding value to it, which will fetch you more money, but you're actually adapting to climate change. But the intent was not necessarily to do that. So adaptation in the continent is an opportunity for world creation. So I see climate action through the adaptation lens as the biggest opportunity for the continent to be able to lift people from the bottom of the pyramid and put poverty on the run and prosperity into the cockpit of progress.
Perfect. And now, looking at this truth that you have said about Africa not emitting so much as other countries, it brings me to the subject of climate financing. Even countries who should finance this get to shy about it. Let me first understand, from your own level of operation and your field of practice, What do you think is wrong with climate financing, especially as it should benefit the African continent?
The reality, let's be realistic here, to be very honest. The politics of climate financing is known to each and everyone. It's politics, and I use it intentionally. And I'm speaking now as a climate change expert, as a climate change and development expert who understands the region. I'm in no way speaking on behalf of my institution. If you look at the politics of climate finance, it is sour, and I use the word sour intentionally, because if you look at Copenhagen in 2009, there was promise of 100 billion.
Yeah.
As we speak today, not up to about 11 billion has been raised from 2009 to now. That's how many years? A decade after. That means the politics of climate finance is something that Africa cannot really benefit from it. What does that mean? There is an African proverb that you start to get wise when you start running out of money. What does that mean in the context of Africa? Africa depending on others to fund climate action in Africa is like someone waiting for food when food has not even been prepared and will not be prepared for a day or for a year. So Africa must look internally. If you look at development assistance that have been coming to the continent, the ODA, what is called the ODA, Overseas Development Assistance, it now not only reduced, but it is going to further reduce, and it is not even up to 1.5% of the entire GDP of the continent anymore. What does that tell us? Africa then must be able to look internally. But the good news is that Africa is actually funding adaptation, but using it for right purposes. There was a report that came out from the United Nations Environment, United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, UNICA, that shows that every year Africa spends $3 billion in adaptation. But the question is the investment going to right places that can be able to create opportunities for people in the continent? And the answer is no. So what needs to be looked at now is what I call innovative financing. That is financing that is not for the classical social style of climate action implementation, okay, where we give it a social financing, but financing that can be utilized as investment financing. Let me take an example. Nigeria is losing food in the form of food service losses worth $9 billion a year. What does that tell us? It means that there are inefficiencies in the entire agro value chain. Food service losses as a result of lack of preservation, as a result of lack of storage, as a result of lack of adding value. That means that if you are to decentralize clean energy to those farmers or to those actors who are producing, whether it is tomato that is costing the country 28 billion naira every year as a result of food service losses, if you were to decentralize, to utilize money, to provide incentives that can help farmers assess, or those actors, let me not even just say farmers, because across the entire value chain, you have people that are not farmers.
Yeah, that's right.
So that you can provide opportunities for people to assess clean energy to add value. You will be addressing climate change because you will be lowering emissions, helping people put money in their pocket without adding to emissions. And that means that if you can incentivize banks to be able to loan at a low interest rate, and in the course of default, you can cover from that money they're spending in social financing, just giving it for action to happen, you will be addressing an economic problem, an environmental problem, a social problem, and actually putting more finances in people's pockets. That is generating financial dividends. So we need a paradigm shift in Africa to be able to drive climate action. One where we see climate change as an investment opportunity, but whereby we utilize financing to create more opportunities and generate more finance, not just as social funding to adapt to climate change, which has been what Africans love to see. Money, 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 no deal.
But then I see climate smart agriculture as one of the innovative approach.
Climate smart agriculture is not new. These are nomenclature, these are terms. Ecosystem-based adaptation is not new. These are terms. Our mothers in villages have used climate smart agriculture for millennia today, before we were born, and even after we were born. Our mothers don't have the opportunity even to apply chemicalized fertilizers. They've been using what is called millstream, whereby they've also been using organic manure, which has actually helped not just to strengthen the soil, but at the same time also use approaches that are not destroying the soil. So these approaches do exist. We can bring them to scale without destroying the very environment, ensuring that the ecosystems that provide our water, ensuring that the pollinators like bees that pollinate up to 75% of the food we depend on are intact. That's fine. My argument has been this, and I would say it without any fear of contradiction. Production in the continent is not what Africa is facing a problem in only. I use the word only in capital letters. O, capital O, N, L, Y. And I underline it again. We have been made to think that if we can be able to adapt from a production perspective, Africa's problems, especially in the area of agriculture or food security, will be solved. Never. Never again in capital letters. Capital N, E, V, E, R, all in capital and underline. Why? Let's take Nigeria. And I like this question. If Nigeria is losing 9 billion because of food service losses, it means the problem is not production. Only.
That's true.
But we make the thing that when we produce more, we solve food insecurity problem. That's not true. It means that the problem is elsewhere in the... So what I'm saying, agriculture must be looked through in a continuum, from production to processing to transportation and to markets.
And all the value chains.
And it must be in a holistic way. Because one problem solved in another, there is another problem happening somewhere else. Where if you don't do a proper diagnosis to solve and you're only solving the symptoms, Africa will never ever... Cameroon, Nigeria, Kenya, Tanzania, Togo, Cote d'Ivoire will continue to sing the same song, dance the same music. But unfortunately, the drum beat have changed. Music has changed, so the dance too needs to change. And so the point I'm trying to make here is that climate action in the continent, especially in the context of agriculture, which is where Africa have competitive advantage, cannot only be seen from the perspective of production. That's a skewed discussion that is tiring, and I'm tired with it. Production in a way that works with environment and not against the environment, using nature-based approaches, what we call ecosystem-based adaptation, but with value added to what is produced, using clean energy, even how it is produced, solar power irrigation where need be, utilize clean energy, solar dryers to dry vegetables or to add value to dry cassava, but connected to markets. But to connect to markets, we must be connecting to market what is produced in such a way that is good for your health and good for my health. How do you produce? How do you process? Did you add to emissions? Did you destroy the very ecosystems? Because we are now having a population that is becoming climate conscious,
yeah.
Is becoming environmentally conscious, and all these aspects means that how you produce in future, even now, will also impact your profitability if it is not done in a way that is environmentally friendly.
Yeah.
And that means that if we start looking at it from this perspective, we'll be preparing our very own citizens for a market that will emerge tomorrow, because I'm speaking today, the food market in Africa is 150 billion. Our poor Africans are importing food worth 35 billion, sitting on a gold mine, not knowing.
Now, to close this thought now, one thing I like and appreciate about you and having conversations with you is the fact that you see solutions to some of these challenges. So how would you summarize, looking from a very positive angle, this old threat that climate change poses to us as a people?
In every adversity, there are seats of equal or greater benefit. What this African proverb tells us is that there is reward in solving challenges. Every challenge is a disguised opportunity. Climate change is the biggest disguised opportunity for the African continent. Why do I say so? If you look at this connecting the dots paradigm that I've painted here, especially in the agro value chain, Africa agro value chain is worth $1 trillion in less than 11 years. That means that if it is fully expanded in less than 11 years from there, it's $1 trillion. It is the value chain whereby if value is added, using clean energy, it is affordable, 365 days of sunshine. The continent will be able to create 17 million jobs each and every year. But as we're speaking today, 12 million youth are getting into the labor market every year and competing only with 3 million jobs.
Yeah.
That's terrible. But if you can create 17 million jobs, you absorb 12 million and have surplus. Under the changing climate, what gives me hope is that the generation we have today, especially the youthful population, they can be able to seize opportunities that are actually already existing, that the other generations that came before us, they could not seize them. What am I saying this? The interconnectedness, especially through social media. What the youth are doing in Kenya, where they have already developed an application called Ebago Pamoja, which simply is a one-stop shop that engages other actors and engages with those who are dealing with transportation, with clean energy, like solar dryers. Youth in Nigeria can be able to engage with them without necessarily having to go to Kenya to be able to be interconnected. But these are solutions for climate action, but they're also world-creating opportunity. So what gives me hope under the changing climate is that we have a population that is tech-savvy, we have people that can be able to seize opportunity. But this hope is not without caveats. Africans need to seize opportunities, but sometimes we always sit and wait for others to come and tell us what to do. But what I'm hopeful about is that you, saying you, who is interviewing me here today, you will not just be passing this message, but you will be passing the message from a solution opportunity perspective, because we Africans love discussing challenges rather than opportunities.
So you tell me, how else could I have rounded off this episode of the Climate Talk podcast show with Dr. Richard Munnang? Arieku's last thoughts: we must begin to discuss more opportunities than we discuss challenges. We must begin to discuss more opportunities than we discuss challenges. And I hope you can take this with you even after this podcast. Thank you so much for your time. It was a pretty lengthy conversation, but I believe it was worth every second, having to learn so much. Dr. Richard Munnang, thank you so much for your time. To my team, Olumide Idowu, Jimo Oluwatobisegun, and everyone who has made this possible. And please remember, the Climate Talk podcast is a monthly podcast where we discuss everything about climate change, climate action, climate finance, just everything around about climate. We call it a wrap on this episode of the Climate Talk podcast show. Not to worry, we'll be back next month. Always check the website www.climatetalkpodcast.com for updates. And if you have questions, if you have inquiries, feel free to reach out at ClimateWeb on Twitter, at Media4CC on Twitter, or you could send me a mail at debotesei@gmail.com. adebotesei@gmail.com. I'll be glad to read from you. Is there a way you think we can make this better? Is there something you'll be looking forward to listening to in subsequent episodes of the Climate Talk podcast? Feel free to reach out to me. And together, we'll continue to drive practical actions, actionable solutions towards making sure that we win climate change with our innovative climate actions. My name is Seifunmi Adebote. Thank you for listening.